Today in Studio 360, Woody Boyd was this young bartender with dreams of making it in the theater.
Miss Howe, this is my golden chance. I have to do this.
25 years later, the real Woody Harrelson is trying to make it in the theater as a playwright and director.
I feel kind of comfortable with it. Like, I'm usually a very indecisive person, but when I'm directing, somehow, you know, I feel really decisive.
You're a father. Doesn't that give you some skill in being the commander in chief?
No, that would go to the mother.
Oh. And in Wyoming, a big sculpture suddenly disappears from the middle of the university campus. Just a normal limited-run art installation? Or did the energy industry kill a work with an environmental message? That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up on the show today, the actor Woody Harrelson, who's written and directed a new play opening this week in New York City. My conversation with Woody Harrelson and lots more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But first, I want to talk about public art, which a lot of us tend to ignore or overlook until it suddenly disappears. Penn State has just removed its statue of the late football coach Joe Paterno. Last year, Maine's governor removed a mural that celebrated labor history from the state's Department of Labor building. And just recently, the University of Wyoming removed a sculpture that had been on a campus lawn for less than a year. The piece was called Carbon Sink, a 36-foot-wide circle of charred logs set in a spiral like a vortex on a bed of Wyoming coal. I wanted to talk with a couple of people close to the story in Wyoming. First, Jeffrey Lockwood, a professor at the University of Wyoming who's been blogging about the controversy. Lockwood is an entomologist, and early on, before the sculpture existed, he told the artist Chris Drury about pine beetles, pests that are killing trees all over the West, apparently because winters aren't cold enough anymore.
He was intrigued by this, what would you call it, a bit of a karma kickback, right, where Wyoming is the biggest producer of fossil fuels, and here we have climate change sort of feeding back into the state of Wyoming with these immense expanses of dying trees. And so I think that piqued his interest.
So when Carbon Sink was installed last summer, was it this problematic, controversial thing from the get-go?
I think it was from early on. It did what it was intended to do, which was to make people think about our relationship between the ways in which we derive energy and the consequences of those decisions. Well, it was targeting everyone who participates in the production and consumption of energy. We're all culpable with regard to climate change. Of course, in Wyoming, where we have such an enormous amount of fossil fuel extraction, mm-hmm. So that's a lightning rod as well.
And when the university, your colleagues at the University of Wyoming suddenly announced this spring, okay, that's it. It's been there almost a year. We're getting rid of it. They say, oh, no, it was always intended to be a temporary installation. I guess you don't buy that.
Well, actually, there was no announcement. It was just done. No, and basically, it's clear from interviews that were conducted last year and from conversations I've had with the artist that there was an understanding and every intention to allow the piece to decay in place over a period of probably 5 to 10 years. He understood it that way. Apparently, the director of the art museum understood it that way.
And you have no doubt that the university administration made this decision because it was an anti-coal mining embarrassment to them?
Well, I think they made the decision because the energy industry, which is politically very influential in the state of Wyoming, was unhappy and was putting pressure on those legislators, particularly in energy-rich counties. And that trickled down to the university in a very clear way, that this sort of artwork was not appreciated. It was a political response to political pressure.
So the logs and the chunks of coal that made up this sculpture have been dismantled. Where are they now?
They're in three places. The largest logs are apparently in what the University of Wyoming physical plant calls its boneyard, which is, I guess, a place where large junked items are kept in case they have some future use. The smaller logs were taken to the dump, and the coal in the middle of the sculpture was taken to the university power plant and has now been converted into energy, which seems somehow both poetic and ironic.
Professor Jeffrey Lockwood of the University of Wyoming. He's convinced that state legislators played a role in getting the sculpture carbon sink removed from campus. So I also called up Tom Lubnow. He is the Republican majority leader in the Wyoming House of Representatives, and he represents Gillette, the center of a huge fossil fuel region.
I got a phone call from a reporter that said they're putting up an anti-carbon sculpture at the University of Wyoming. And my reaction was just that I thought it was a little hypocritical to use carbon dollars to fund an anti-carbon sculpture. Between 60% and 80% of the state of Wyoming's budget comes from energy generated by the state of Wyoming. And that was my whole point in pointing that out.
So it wasn't as though you and the extraction industry, the coal industry, were demanding that the university get rid of this. They just, but for whatever reasons, political or otherwise, just decided to take it down after a year, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, how long is long enough? It was a temporary sculpture from the start. The artist wanted it to stay there till it decayed into nothingness. How long do you let a piece of art rot and decay before you take it out?
So the legislature, your legislature, has this new provision that requires approval of art installed to be made by the Energy Resources Council of the university and the governor's office. Is the point of that provision to avoid controversial art in the future?
No, well, you're making a broad sweeping generalization there. It's art going into one building on one part of campus. University of Wyoming administration still controls all of the art on all of the rest of the campus, and they actually control the art in this building, too, because they're going to bring the art to the Energy Resources Council and the governor for this one building. What's wrong with allowing one building to have industry have approval of or the veto power on a few pieces of art in this one building? You put a plaque on the wall that says, thank you for donating to my program.
Right.
That's what this is it's a plaque on a wall in a gym.
Yeah, but isn't it also that there's this resource, Energy Resources Council, that can say, nah, we don't want that work of art put in this building?
Yes, we don't want that plaque on the wall. We want this plaque on the wall. It celebrates the culture and heritage of the state of Wyoming.
Yeah.
In terms of transportation and agriculture and mining.
Well, Tom, I really appreciate your spending the time to talk with us today.
Well, I appreciate you giving a simple country legislator from the boondocks of Wyoming the chance to come on to the big dog show and share thoughts.
Hey, you're the House Majority Leader. You're not such a little country legislator.
I'm a simple country legislator from the boondocks of Wyoming. Ask anybody.
Yeah, I've heard very powerful people say things like that a lot in the past. But thank you for talking with me.
Oh, well, thank you, Kurt. Have a good day.
Tom Lubnow is the Republican Majority Leader of the Wyoming House of Representatives. So, what do you all think? How much say should donors to a university have over the art and culture that gets installed and performed there? Let us know what you think at studio360.org. Coming up, who figured that cute kid on Cheers would turn out to be one of the best American actors of his generation?
You will never work if you don't get that space filled in between your teeth, right? Then other people will be like, you have to get rid of your accent. If you don't get rid of your accent, I guarantee you won't work. You know, people who have good jobs, very knowledgeable, and they're just wrong.
Woody Harrelson, that's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Thank you. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A couple of weeks ago, there was one of those Twitter hashtag games about titles of novels that could be turned into names for cocktails. It occurred to me that every F. Scott Fitzgerald book could be a cocktail with no changes at all. Great Gatsby? Maybe Gin and Bitters. This Side of Paradise? Pink, with an umbrella. The Beautiful and the Damned? Tabasco on the rim. Tender as the Night? Something sweet and creamy I would never drink. Since summer is when people tend to get elaborate with drinks, we want some recipes from you for new cocktails named after classic works of literature. Would tomato juice be required for a Scarlet Letter? And a Finnegan's Wake. Irish whiskey, sure, big, yes, maybe kind of undrinkable. Send us your ideas, and in a few weeks, we'll bring in an expert to help me pick the winning drink. Your entry should capture the spirit of the book and taste good. You've got until end of day Sunday, August 12th, to send us your cocktail titles and recipe. Who would have thought that that sweet, dopey bartender on the TV show Cheers would turn into one of the most versatile, interesting actors of his time? Woody Harrelson has played a stone-faced Marine, a porn king, a sociopathic criminal, a complicated cop, charming gay guys, and more. And now he has co-written and directed a play, very loosely autobiographical, called Bullet for Adolf. It takes place during a summer of partying hard and working construction in Houston with a buddy named Frankie Hyman.
Frankie Hyman was an amazing guy, you know. He just had grown up in Harlem and was 10 years older and had a lot of life experience. And so he made a deep impact on me. And from the end of that summer, I just kept thinking about him. And I called him a few times, but then eventually he moved from Houston, and then he didn't leave any forwarding. We didn't know how to get a hold of him, and there was no way to get a hold of him. I even hired a PI at some point, and finally I went on Leno and said, if anyone knows Frankie Hyman, have him get in touch.
So when you decided, okay, it's time for me to make this play, did you decide you had to do it with Frankie, this guy you hadn't really seen in years?
Well, at the time, Frankie was going through some hard times when I reunited with him. And I thought, he's a terrific storyteller. I read some stuff, like journal stuff he wrote from when he was in rehab. And I read that. I said, I'm telling you, you can write. Can't spell, but you can write.
You don't have to spell in the theater.
He'd be pissed if he heard me say that. But he's a terrific writer, and it was good for him also just to start working on this and focusing on this instead of all the other stuff. And given
that, as you say, he's been in rehab, that there is a lot of smoking of weed and drinking and the rest in this play, was that tricky going there in the writing of this thing?
No, not at all. I mean, he's totally... He doesn't like to be around that kind of thing, but to be writing about it is no problem for him, you know. And we didn't want to be squeamish about the things that you can see that the humor is kind of often a challenging humor, like, you know, we challenge you to laugh at this.
Yeah, like Hitler jokes.
Yeah, Hitler jokes, and, you know, we pretty much joke about almost everything possible except for retarded people, which I don't like jokes about retarded people. So
I think that's a good line to draw.
Yeah, that's the one line we did draw, but we tried to go into every other possible demographic.
Had you written things before?
Yeah, I did. I wrote a one act before, and that turned out pretty good. But I think probably one of the best attributes a writer can have is to be hungry. Yeah, I haven't really been hungry. I've had a cushy life, and so, you know.
Well, do you feel, I mean, you obviously don't need to feel hungry in a physical sustenance sense, or, you know, I mean, you have this amazing acting career. Do you feel hungry to be a writer, to be a director? Does that feel like hunger?
Yeah, I mean, I really do feel that, but I have to fight my my laziness. Like, it's a real battle.
Yeah?
Will the hunger overcome the laziness?
And are you lazier now than you used to be, or have you just been always a lazy person? And 40 movies in 25 years would seem to belie the laziness thing.
Well, you do have to... You know, yeah, I definitely have to work sometimes, but I, when I'm not working, geez, I'm about as lazy as you could. I don't know how the wifey tolerates me. You just got to kick me off the couch or something. But I'm probably not as lazy as I pretend to be. But
it's a charming guy's.
Yeah, right. It probably is also a fear thing, you know, like the fear of, you know, really taking on writing something.
You opened it out of town. You opened it in Toronto in April. It got mixed reviews there. Yeah?
Yeah, I never read the reviews.
Really?
I don't read reviews. I only did that one mistake one time.
You don't even read reviews of your film performances? Or?
Never.
Really?
Never.
That shows real restraint.
Yeah, well, last time I did read something, I was doing a play, actually. It was in San Francisco. It was with Sean Penn and Nick Nolte. And everybody was telling me, oh, my God, your reviews are just phenomenal. You can't believe how well you got reviewed. And I was like, oh, that's cool, you know. And, of course, I wasn't going to look at it. But then I was laying on the floor stretching. I'm in San Francisco, but I see L.A. Times has opened up, and there's a picture of me and Sean on stage. And, before I knew it, I'm reading it and probably hungry for a little ego boost. Scathing. I was like, okay, that's the last time
the last time you trust the person who said they were phenomenal.
Well, you know, maybe a bunch of other ones were, but this one certainly wasn't. It was specifically kind of mean
to you?
Me. Yeah.
So have you had?
But I don't know. Regardless of what they said in
right.
Toronto, the audience loved it. So
and did you
I,
have
I
you worked
know.
On it since then? Have you?
Oh yeah,
rewritten?
A lot of work since then. And, you know, 6 new actors as well.
You're also the director of it. Had you done that before or anything like it to prepare you for being the boss?
Well, I just did This Is Our Youth up in Toronto, and that went really well. I'm usually a very indecisive person, but when I'm directing, somehow, you know, I feel really decisive, you know.
Yeah. You're a father. Doesn't that give you some skill in being the commander in chief?
No, that would go to the mother.
Oh.
My wife is the commander in chief. I told the kids early on, I said, listen, she's the boss. Don't even, you know.
Don't pay attention to me.
If you're going to try to get around her, forget it. Don't go to me, the softy. She's the one.
And I read that in this production, you do yoga with the cast every day. Is that right?
Yeah. Doing yoga before you perform is really important to just relax you. You want to be in the most relaxed state possible when you get out on stage.
Are you a yoga practitioner?
Yeah. I've been practicing it a while. Yoga fine. What about you?
I've done yoga in the past, and I return to it every now and then. Do Pilates sometimes. I do all those things.
That's cool.
But I'm, you know, I'm just then my teacher moves away, and I stop doing it until my wife makes me do it again. After that post college summer, you turned 22 in Houston. You moved to New York to try to break into the theater. How did that go?
Well, at first it was a little bit rocky. It seemed like there was this strange catch-22 of you can't get an agent unless they've seen you in something, and how are they going to see you in something unless an agent sends you on the audition, you know?
And you can't get an equity unless you've been in something. You can't be in something unless you've been in
it. Yeah, it just was this vicious, weird circle where I went to New York feeling quite confident just based on my experience in theater in Hanover College. And I got more and more depressed. I actually sunk into a depression, and one of my roommates, Rob, comes into my room, and he sees me. I'm just laying there on the bed, middle of the afternoon, and staring up at the peeling paint on the ceiling and wondering what the hell I've done with my life. You know, at this point, I guess I was about 23. And he says, get up out of this friggin' bed and go take your pictures around and just go to the agencies and drop them off and do something. So I went up and I went around. I did that. And, you know, you drop off the pictures and they drop them in that circular filing cabinet.
Yeah.
And but it was probably, must have been 2 weeks later before I got a call. I had given up. And this lady, she said her name is Marsha Bonin, and she was with the Gage Group, and would I be interested in coming and meeting her? She says, I see something interesting in your face. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. I said, but why didn't you call sooner? And she says, I called you several times, and every time this girl answered and said you weren't here and hung up, and it was my girlfriend at the time who was very jealous. And she would hang up, just slam the phone down. And luckily, you know, she called one time when I picked up. So.
And did you ever think if your roommate hadn't said, dude, get off the bed and go out and put yourself out? I mean, could you have had an alternative life that was not at all what you've had in the last 25 years? Could you have just...
You mean to not be an actor?
Correct.
You know, like a waiter?
Or whatever.
I mean, I was...
Or gone back and sold insurance in Indiana.
I was a dismal waiter, and I found that I'm a terrible salesperson because, you know, a big part of this business that I never really realized going into it is sales. You know, you make a movie, but then you got to go sell the movie. And I'm terrible about that. I don't know how to talk about a thing to make it more intriguing or enticing. This particular project, I think, is fantastic, and I think if people like to laugh, hopefully they'll go see it. But
well, and it's you. It's easier to sell because, you know, in real life you don't, for instance, kill zombies, but this has some connection to your actual life. So presumably it's easier to sell.
I won't admit to having killed any zombies.
But maybe. Zombieland was a movie that I went with my kids, didn't expect to love, just loved it. Loved your character, loved the movie, where you play this Twinkie-eating, zombie-killing cowboy. I want to play a clip.
You're going to risk our lives for a Twinkie?
There's a box of Twinkies in that grocery store. Not just any box of Twinkies. The last box of Twinkies that anyone will enjoy in the whole universe. Believe it or not, Twinkies have an expiration date. Someday very soon, life's little Twinkie gauge is gonna go empty. Time to nut up or shut up.
That's Woody Harrelson with Jesse Eisenberg in Zombieland. Now, what convinced you on the basis of a script or whatever to take that? Because that could have been a bad movie. It was a great movie. But how do you know when you read a script that, this is worth doing?
Well, that was one that I had sitting for a while on the... I had a little stack of scripts, and I remember that sitting at the bottom. It said Zombieland, and I never really wanted to read it because I thought, I mean, has it come to this? I'm going to make a zombie? And then my agent kept telling me, read the damn script, and he really kind of rode me hard for a minute because I just... As soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh, boy, this is pretty good. You know, a lot of it, my agent, Jeremy Plager, was telling me, look, we're swinging for the fences, and, you know, if it's bad, it's going to be a disaster, but if it's good, he thought I should do it right away, and I'm glad I did that.
You are something of a spokesperson for organic agriculture and veganism and weed and everything that you famously do. Do you have to figure out, I'm an actor, I don't want to be a spokesman, this is how much I want to be a spokesman?
Well, I mean, I don't consider myself a spokesman for any of those things. I just speak my mind when people ask me about it. I certainly don't consider myself a spokesman for herb because my philosophy is straight edge. You know, whether or not I'll ever be that, I don't know, but that's my philosophy.
Really? That's like, yeah. You mean like a Catholic who says he's a Catholic but he sins?
Right. Yeah, I mean, if there are Catholics who sin, then I think that's a good
analogy. I think there
are
a few, yeah.
mostly in the hierarchy, probably. But you know, I do believe in healthy eating, and I find that, for example, that it's very hard to preach to people. You know, people, you stand between someone and their meat, you know, you can get very uncomfortable. It's because people do like
it's a funny idea.
Their steak or their yeah. hamburger or what have you.
You recently played the Republican strategist Steve Schmidt in the HBO movie Game Change about the John McCain, Sarah Palin campaign.
Governor, this country has just elected the first African-American president in the history of its existence. And it is the concession speech that will legitimize his succession as commander-in-chief. It is a serious and solemn occasion, and John McCain, and only John McCain, will be giving this sacred speech. This is how it has been done in every presidential election since the dawn of the Republic. And you, Sarah Palin, will not change the importance of this proud American tradition.
Among other things, your portrayal of him immediately made him more beloved in the world and sort of turbocharged the second act of his career, it seems. Is that weird to have that kind of effect by suddenly people think of Steve Schmidt as Woody Harrelson playing Steve Schmidt?
Yeah, I never thought about that, but it was funny that, you know, I went recently to the correspondence dinner, and I went with...
In Washington, yeah.
Yeah, I went with Steve, and people were saying to me, you know, that guy you played in the movie is on the other... He's over there on the other side of the room here. I'm like, yeah, I know, I came with him. And people would be so surprised that we're friends. And we are kind of diametrically opposed on a lot of... There's certain issues we can't really discuss, but we did become friends. And I'm really proud to have gotten to play him. I think he's really a cut above the average political person I've met. You know, the average political person I've met is a cut below most paparazzi, in fact.
Really? But, you're not a fan of political types?
Not a fan, not at all. It's hard to believe in it, isn't it?
This isn't perhaps the golden age for political figures in America. People with these this killings in the Colorado movie theater the other week, people have, in the endless articles about it, and what does this mean, what do we do about it, mention was made of Natural Born Killers, the Oliver Stone movie that you were in
yeah.
20 years ago. Does making movies like that, should filmmakers, should people making them have any pause about making them if there are psychos out there who take them as some kind of instruction manual?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody watches a movie and becomes a homicidal
right.
maniac.
Right.
I think that there's a lot of factors going on, and you know, not to say that it's the influence is nil, but I just can't imagine that it creates violence. You know, on the other hand, you know, I wonder why they don't talk more about pharmaceuticals, because almost without exception, these kids who do the school killings, they're all on antidepressants, you know. And there's something unnatural about taking these antidepressants and basically putting a prophylactic around your emotions and thinking that you can just, you know, kind of jerry-rig the system to work for you. You know, I mean, it has to be addressed, and it will be addressed, because ultimately it kind of explodes into something. You know, not all the time does it get violent, but I just don't think they work.
Right.
You know, and I got a lot of friends who take antidepressants and believe in them, you know. But
in terms of movies, or you don't feel any... Do you think about, what will be the social impact of this film if I make it?
Yeah, so me trying to shift the target there didn't work for you, did it?
I saw where you were going, your Scientology track there.
Oh, is that a Scientology concept? No.
It's a complicated thing, and I don't have an answer. I don't know what the answer is. But
I mean, I don't know what the answer is either. I felt like that movie was a satire, and it was making a comment on society and media's influence on this kind of thing. So, ironically, it was kind of taken very seriously and not as a satire.
In the 30 years since you were the struggling actor and the construction worker in Houston and all that, are there pieces of bad advice about show business that people have given you along the way?
Well, I remember before I really got started, you know, when I just moved to New York and I met with, I think it was a casting person or otherwise an agent or something. And the guy says, you will never work if you don't get that space filled in between your teeth, right? Then other people be like, you have to get rid of your accent. If you don't get rid of your accent, I guarantee you won't work. You know, people who, you know, have good jobs, very knowledgeable, and they're just wrong, you know? So there were some, I would have hated to got rid of this space in between my teeth.
Yeah. I know. You've got a good life, huh?
Oh, great. It just, I can't imagine a better life. It's awesome.
Woody Harrelson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great to be here. Great job.
Thank you. The play Bullet for Adolf opens off Broadway next weekend. And I want to play you out. We're going to play you out on this Ziggy Marley song on which you sing. How did this come about?
Oh, I went over to Ziggy's house. He called me up and said, come on over. He lives down the street in L.A. I said, I wonder if you'd want to sing some of these lines on this song I got. All right, sure, let's do it.
A crime against nations, a war is waged. There's a message in the wind for every race. Peace and love we sow, so let us grow. It's good for the body.
The actor and now director and playwright Woody Harrelson. If you're maybe young and know him only for his role in the Hunger Games movie, you can hear him talk a bit about that at studio360.org.
I see marijuana trees blowing in the breeze. I see hemp fields forever growing wild and free.
Coming up, another venerable profession ruined by the movies.
You teach yourselves the law, but I train your mind. You come in here with a skull full of mush, and you leave thinking like a lawyer.
That's in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The writer Gore Vidal died this week. I grew up watching him on talk shows, chatting with Johnny Carson and then Dick Cavett about 60s politics and culture and the decline of America. When I just made my way to Manhattan in the late 1970s, I happened to be a guest at the infamous cocktail party where Norman Mailer decked him. I didn't meet Gore Vidal until years later, in 2009, when he came on Studio 360 to talk about his last memoir. He wrote fantastic memoirs. He'd known pretty much everybody worth knowing in America for more than half a century. In our interview, he told me about the time he went shooting with John F. Kennedy and Tennessee Williams.
Well, yes. I was down in Key West getting ready to, at Tennessee's request, to write the movie of Suddenly Last Summer. And Jack was on his way to being nominated for president, and it was fairly clear that he had the nomination, but he was getting a little restless thinking about those votes. And then he suggested that I'm very nearsighted, and Tennessee has one extremely bad eye, that he would like to challenge us to some, you know, rifle shooting.
Skeet shooting, right?
Well, no, there was no skeet.
Uh-huh.
We were the skeet. And Jackie groaned, and I said, no. I said, I can shoot, and I think the bird, as I call Tennessee, the bird is a good shot. And Jack was in one radiant mood, and so we started shooting on the lawn in front of the house in Palm Beach. To wind up the story, Tennessee got bullseye every time, and Jack was missing the target altogether every time. Jack looked rather as though somebody had run over him to have been defeated by a blind man. But
and this blind man, Tennessee Williams, also said to you, "That boy has a nice ass," at which you...
No, I said, "Tennessee, stop there. Stop cruising. That's the next president," I said. He said, "Oh, no, the American people will never elect Mr. and Mrs. Kennedy to anything because the American people hate attractiveness in everything. And they'll never vote for them." I said, "They're going to." "Oh, no, we made a bet on it," which I won.
And then you told JFK about this, about your friend's remark.
Yeah, and there's a wonderful picture of Tennessee staring at Jack's back. And I said, "Bird, stop that." And he said, what are you talking about? I'm just looking out over the vista of the sea." And I said, "Well, stop looking at the sea."
You could go on the road just doing impersonations of well-known people of the 20th century.
"What do you think I'm doing?"
Gore Vidal. I spoke with him in 2009. You can hear the full interview and read my brief salute to him at studio360.org. No illness is more associated with a particular symbol than breast cancer is with pink ribbons. An incredibly successful piece of marketing, but for one survivor, supremely annoying.
"I've always hated the color pink. I don't like the association between the infantilization of pink and women, and it always bothered me. And I was actually kind of shocked how much consumerism and how many objects there are that are pink: tennis shoes, the socks, rubber bands, Sharpies. I mean, it's unending."
Leonor Caraballo is a sculptor who makes work with her husband Abu Farman. They've come up with a new approach to representing breast cancer that's got people in that community buzzing. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky has the story.
In 2008, Leonor Caraballo was diagnosed with breast cancer. From the moment the doctor said the word cancer, everything was a blur.
I realized a year later, after I went through the whole cancer management, that I had no idea what they were talking about. I hadn't seen this tumor. I knew it wanted to kill me, but I didn't really understand what it meant.
Now, Leonor is an artist. She needs to process things visually. So she asked the radiologist to give her pictures of the MRI scans. Each scan is a different cross-section of the tumor, like a slice of cake.
You know, there's thousands of slices. So I just looked at each and every one, different angles. And I kept on wanting to see it. I wanted to see it as an object. I wanted to take it basically out of the breast. I wanted to do what the surgeon did with the double mastectomy. I wanted to do that artistically.
She wanted to build a 3D model of her tumor, something she could hold in her hands. The first step was to create a 3D model on the computer, and then a 3D printer would take that blueprint and build a plastic model. It wasn't easy.
The MRI images everything, right? So all the tissue, all the vessels, and the tumor is kind of there with a slightly different shading.
Abu Farman is Leonor's husband and creative partner.
The 3D printer can't print everything. First of all, it'll just go nuts. So it either do surface.
And it would take 3 months to
print. We don't want to just print the surface of a breast. So the first thing was, digitally, how do you just isolate that thing?
And once they isolated that thing in the computer, the 3D printer was like, "I can't print this thing." I mean, you know, if the printer could talk. The tumor was a weird blobby shape with very thin tentacles shooting outward. The artist had to work very closely with a computer technician.
We were, you know, in a way using this extremely high-tech process and then taking it all the way back to...
To the Bronze Age. Lost wax and Bronze Age.
Actually, they took it to a foundry in Queens where the plastic model was cast in bronze. Now Leonor wears a little bronze tumor around her neck.
For me, it's a reminder that I hate the word survivor, but that I'm here and this thing is out of my body and, you know, and I feel more powerful than it.
It means it stopped growing. Okay, that's how it was. That's the final form
it took.
That's how
it was removed, and it's its final form it took, and it's not going to move anymore. It's not going to spread.
But they wanted to make more. So Michelle Drotman, a radiologist at Cornell Medical Center, gave them MRI scans of tumors from different women.
It's just amazing how different it looks outside the breast.
and how different the tumors look from each other. Some look like rock candy, others look like a piece of coral or meteorite.
And that's what cancers usually are. They're not these nice, smooth lesions. They're ugly.
They're aggressive by nature.
Cancers don't follow tissue planes like benign things, which kind of respect the tissue. Tumors just grow, you know, wherever they want.
The couple created a company called Object Breast Cancer. Women can order paperweights, amulets, or worry beads based on their own MRI scans. Or they can order sculptures based on tumors from anonymous women. One of their first customers was Paula de la Cruz. She still cringes when she thinks about the moment the nurse gave her the results.
She handed me the paper and she said, "Oh, I'm so sorry for the bad news." I'm like, "What am I supposed to do? I have no idea."
She turned to her friend, Leonor Carabello, who recommended a surgeon and a radiologist. And then eventually, Leonor sculpted a paperweight based on Paula's tumor. Now Paula's in remission, but she likes having a physical reminder that sits on a stack of bills.
When I was going through the whole healing process, you know, chemotherapy, etc., you know, people use this war, you know, tones like, you gotta beat this, blah, blah. And I always felt it's my body that's chaotic and that's making these cells that are out of control. I mean, how are you at war with your own body?
You're monumentalizing illness.
I talked with the art critic Patty Johnson. She's a blogger who writes for Art Review and Art in America.
I think if you believe that, like, making this thing into a solid object that doesn't move is going to empower you, then obviously, yes, it is empowering. Would I feel that way? No.
It's tricky to evaluate art that handles illnesses like AIDS or breast cancer. I mean, who wants to criticize a victim or a survivor?
I feel like I'm being a jerk right now, and that doesn't feel good. I mean, you asked me to talk about, like, to bring my background and my knowledge to this, and so that's what I have to do. It's part of my job. From a fine art perspective, we would look at the narrative that this work produces, and we would look at the metaphors, and we would say, you know, these metaphors are really obvious. They're a little too concrete. You know, I do wish that it looked a little more dangerous, something that looked otherworldly and a little less like things we already know.
Like a piece of coral or a rock formation.
Then it falls into another genre of art that I like to call invisible history art. So that's when the object doesn't speak to you until you're aware of the backstory.
But that backstory made the sculptures really interesting for Dr. Alexander Swistel. He removed the tumors from Leonor Carabello and Paula de la Cruz. And then suddenly there they were, scaled up, cast in bronze, and sitting in an art gallery.
To actually see it in front of you, and then to actually pick up the sculpture and run your fingers over it and just understand, this is something that I took out. As a surgeon, it was a huge surprise.
Remember the tentacles in the tumors that made it so hard for the artist to build 3D models? Well, in real life, they were misleading Dr. Swistel. They were making him think that the tumors were actually bigger than they were.
We kind of thought to ourselves, well, wait a minute. So maybe we've been going at the treatment all wrong.
So as part of an experiment, he's working with a radiologist, Michelle Drotman, to create 3D models of tumors in the computer, just like the artists. The doctors are going to decide how much radiation to give patients based on the volume of their tumors, not just the widest dimensions.
Making therapeutic decisions based on three-dimensional volume measurements has just never been, to my knowledge, done at all in any kind of setting of any kind of tumor, but certainly for breast cancer.
And clinical trials are underway. He predicts that some of his patients may end up getting less chemotherapy, and maybe none at all. For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
You can see some images of Abu Farman and Leonor Carballo's sculptures on our website, studio360.org. We really do love hearing from our listeners about works of art and entertainment that have changed their lives, such as the email we got from Jonathan Amsbary about a show he loved as a child in the 1960s.
One of my favorite shows at the time was Perry Mason, because he was always defending some innocent person who was caught in the system.
The state is saying your motive for killing Sidemark was your belief that he killed your protege, Barry Conrad. And you're trying to tell me he didn't?
Here was someone who was making sure that justice was done.
I intend to prove he did, and I intend to clear his name.
At the same time, my parents were friends with a bunch of young lawyers from the Legal Aid Society in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they were sort of the real-life Perry Mason. They were all incredibly, you know, attractive and vibrant and energetic, and they could talk to me about going to law school and about becoming a lawyer. My goal was to make a difference, to really help people and to really help clean up the system and make the system do what it's supposed to do, help America be what it's supposed to be. In 1973, I was a senior in high school, and my mother took me to see the movie The Paper Chase. Paper Chase is about a student, John Hart.
My name's Hart. Came to ask you to join my study group.
The Hart character is a young man from the Midwest who comes to Harvard and encounters in his first class, which is contracts, with Professor Kingsfield. And Kingsfield is in the business of making lawyers.
You teach yourselves the law, but I train your mind. You come in here with a skull full of mush, and you leave thinking like a lawyer.
It is not a way that a normal human being looks at an issue of justice, of right and wrong, and that these issues really are irrelevant. It's really about what does the law say? How can the law be manipulated?
Mr. Hart,
it's obvious that notice is not important here. The offer requires no notice. It requires no personal communication.
And
what is important
throughout the movie, what you see is this transformation of this sort of young, idealistic Midwesterner becoming more sort of ground into the system and senses of right and wrong and good and bad get quickly washed away.
I failed. I worked so hard on that goddamn paper. Well, he may flunk me!
They finally got you, didn't they, Hart? They sucked all that Midwestern charm right out of you.
He encounters Kingsfield's daughter, and they start a romance.
Look, he's got you scared to death. Oh, you're going to pass because you're the kind the law school wants.
You know, she confronts him and says, you've been in a paper chase all your life, your high school diploma, your college diploma, now your law degree.
Your piece of paper that's no different than this, and you can stick it in your silver box with all the other paper in your life. Your birth certificate, your driver's license, your marriage license, your stock certificates, and your will.
As if this, okay, your life's over. This is the death of you.
Susan?
Excuse me.
She's saying, you can be a man or you can be a lawyer. And I was buying into the movie and hoping he'd go with her, hoping that he would turn away from and not be so indoctrinated, that this was something that I probably don't want to do, that I don't want to think like that. But I wasn't going to make a decision based on a movie, and so I needed to do more research and I needed to find out. And I wound up speaking with one of these legal aid lawyers that I had gotten to know who had become a professor. And he explained to me that the movie was pretty much dead on and that lawyers are mostly people who help write contracts, who help people who have money make more money, and you know, the Perry Masons of the world don't really make a living because the little guy who is trapped in the system doesn't have the money to pay you. And so if you're going to make a living at it, you have to, in a sense, be that Kingsfield. You have to be that cog in the machine. And I decided that isn't what I want it to be. And now I'm a professor of communication studies here at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And most of the things I teach are in the realm of how people talk to each other, how they work in organizations, how they work in groups. I teach classes in interviewing and small group communication. And, you know, my students can take what I'm teaching them and really make things better for themselves. A lot of them first-generation students, a lot of them from lower-income families. And this is really a good leg up for them. They come back afterwards and say, you know, you helped me in my job interview and I negotiated a better paycheck for myself, or in some way that really is kind of a marvelous feeling, and that's been very gratifying for me. I don't know if I found justice, but I think I'm at least helping the little guy.
Jonathan Amsbury listens to our show in Birmingham, Alabama on WBHM. Studio 360's Jenny Lawton produced that piece with help from Mujahid Seliman. And that does it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Don't forget, in the meanwhile, to enter our literary cocktail contest. Send us your recipe for a drink named after some well-known piece of literature. All the details are at studio360.org. And you can see what's happening on the show every day on Flipboard or Google Currents. And you can find me on Twitter at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Mujahid Seliman,
Eve Asher,
Julia Wetherill.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, this respectable, straight-laced, middle-aged couple becomes obsessed with the dance of passion.
They say, but you don't look like somebody who's danced tango. I probably look very nerdy.
Blame it on the tango. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.